I'm Georgie Crawford. You're listening to the Good Glow podcast. Throughout my treatment for breast cancer, I've realised the importance of self-care. Whether it's a trip to the gym, a checkup with your GP, or even a five-minute pamper session, the time has come for us to put ourselves higher on our own to-do list. I'll speak to people who remind us to take better care of ourselves and people who will motivate us and inspire positive change. This podcast is made possible by Sally Hansen, the creator of which was an inspirational woman who promoted the message of self-care all the way back in the 1930s. Whether it's a quick tan application or a cuticle oil top-up, Sally Hansen wants us to have the power to feel like our best selves. This week on the Good Glow podcast, I talk to Jenny Miller. Jenny's family moved to Sri Lanka from Dublin in 2014 when her husband Eric, a former Irish international rugby star, was offered a coaching job. Little did they know they'd fall head over heels for a little two-year-old girl called Nisha from a nearby orphanage. Jenny, Eric and their daughter Hannah decided as a family that they would adopt Nisha after they all felt an incredible connection with her the first time they met. This story is truly incredible. I'm so grateful to Jenny for sharing it with us all. I really hope you enjoy this episode. Jenny, thank you so much for joining me on my podcast today.
No problem. It's great to be here, Georgie. Thanks a million.
We know each other through Becky Miller. He used to work in Spin. She's your sister-in-law. And I bumped into Becky in Cornell's Court about 2 months ago. And she started to tell me your story. And I was rooted to the spot for about 40 minutes. It's an incredible story. I'm so grateful and thankful that you've come in today to tell it.
Thank you so much. I was actually looking at some of the Good Glow last night and listening and preparation and got a bit intimidated, I'll be honest, when I saw some of the names, and I was thinking, I'm just a regular gal. Obviously, this happened to me, but yeah, I certainly got a bit intimidated. But I'm so glad to meet you, and your story really inspired me as well, George.
Oh, and I'm so glad that the Good Glow can help share your story. Tell us a little bit about your life before you went to Sri Lanka, what life was like for you day to day.
Yeah, so I would say life was really good. Eric had retired in 2006 from rugby. And he was coaching, and we had a little baby. Hannah would have been about six at the time when we left. But yeah, life was great. I was working, I'm a personal trainer, but we just felt a bit of a spiritual unrest is probably the best way to put it. Like something inside of us was wanting to move, but we didn't know where or what was going on, but we were praying about it and we're thinking, we want to do something, we want to go away, to have an adventure maybe. So kind of that's where we were at. But certainly, I would say now looking back, life was great. I was like, why did we change? But it was worth it. It was so worth it.
So then this coaching role came up for Eric in Sri Lanka. And did it, like, was there a lot of discussion around whether you should go or not? Like, it's such a huge move.
Yeah, and look, I'd been to Spain and France on my holidays. I'd never been really anywhere that adventurous before. And we were actually looking at America for many years. And Eric was actually flown over and back by a crowd. They were going to do like rugby camps. And we were really excited about that. But then in May 2014, the whole thing just shut down. Like the sponsorship went and it wasn't happening. And we were like, okay, what are we going to do? So we went out for dinner with a South African friend and his wife. And they brought up Sri Lanka. The word, I remember hearing the word at the table. I'd never known anything about it apart from the cricket. My ears pricked up and I went, what's this? And they said, well, there's a school in Sri Lanka, a big rugby school looking for a coach. And we both looked at one another. Now, that was in May 2014. And it was like we instantly went, we're supposed to go. Within 3 months, we were on the plane with Hannah. Like, it was so guided, I feel. Now, obviously, I know why now, but certainly it couldn't be the furthest thing away from America. First world, America, you know, glam. And then suddenly we end up going to the third world. It was like, wow.
And what was the reaction of your family when you told them you guys were going?
I think they knew we wanted to go. somewhere. But when we mentioned Sri Lanka, of course, people were eyes were open a bit because they thought it was all cricket and not rugby. So they didn't understand. But certainly when we got excited about it and we said, look, it'll be great for Hannah. It'll show her something else, a bit of an experience. It won't be for, it'll be a few years, but it won't be forever. Yeah, so they kind of got excited for us, I think, then in the end. They supported us and they were sad we were leaving, and particularly with Hannah, but they supported us.
So did it feel like this big family adventure? Like, what was it like when you went to the airport that morning to
Amazing. I was like... Actually, I was looking up online, you know, psyching myself up, you know, the third world, I can do this, I can do this. And I was looking at videos and people's YouTube holiday videos. And I was like, okay, yeah, even though it did look really pretty, there was the other side of it too. And I was looking at those videos of, you know, people, lots of busy, kind of a, an assault on the senses almost. But when we arrived, we went to Dubai on the way, which of course is lovely, and did a bit of a 2-day holiday. And we arrived. And the boss arrived at the airport to pick us up with this extremely glamorous wife and a big Jeep. And I was like, what? Then they checked us into a lovely hotel in Colombo. So it was funny. It was almost like it was completely different to what I imagined it to be. But then we hit Kandy 3 or 4 days later in the centre of the island. And that certainly was so different.
And what was Hannah like with that transition? Did you explain to her that, you know, you guys had just, you're going off on a big adventure for 2 years and you would eventually come home? Was that the plan?
Yeah, we didn't know when. And she's an amazing child. And you know what? As I go through the story, you'll see how incredible she was. And I think it's really shaped her as a person. You know, it's important to know that as a family, you can travel and you can go away. People do it all the time. And to show a child what we showed Hannah, it's priceless, because we're so cushioned here, Georgie, you know, and we can't help it but to love our children and give them everything that they want. But to show her the other side and that children are abandoned and marginalised, she saw that. It's really given her a heart, I feel. And it's something I'm so glad I did, because people would say, it's not right to bring your child there. And as in the orphanage, which I'll get to in a minute. But certainly we're glad we did, and it's helped her as a person. So I don't regret a minute of it.
What were those first couple of weeks like there?
Looking back, I think I was just in shock, I think. Kandy, it was just so different. It's beautiful, like there's coconut trees and it's idyllic. But then when you go into the centre and you see the poverty, it's hard. And I've always been a person who sort of felt sad to see that. So that was hard for me. But yeah, we were just getting stuck in and moving into our place and getting Hannah into school there. And I remember the first morning we went to school, we got a tuk-tuk, which is, you know, the little tuk-tuk cars. And the dog was chasing us up the road barking, and Hannah was in her uniform and a pair of shorts, and we were on our way to school. And I thought, this is like, what happened to my life? You know, it's like from going from Dublin to that. But then I remember thinking, this is amazing. I'm so glad I'm here doing this, because it's just so out there, and it was brilliant.
And what was she like going to school? Like, was she scared?
She was quiet. So I suppose, yeah, looking back, she would have been. But she adapted really well. Now, she was the only white kid in her class for a long time until Gethin arrived, a little Welsh boy. And she's so fair skinned. So they were fascinated with her and they stared at her. And, you know, she was always just getting attention. But she got some little pals. And I don't know if it was her favourite time of her life in the school necessarily, but it was a lovely school. It was an international school, but all mostly Sri Lankans, English speaking. But yeah, no, she was brilliant. She did it. And then she got some friends. And once she had friends, it, of course, for children, that makes it so much easier.
And Eric then was doing the coaching, and you were at home, and you couldn't work because you didn't have a visa.
That's right. So I legally can't work in Sri Lanka based on a spouse visa that I had with Eric. So he was coaching the team and just bedding in. So we went to church. We were in a local church we found immediately when we went there, a little Christian church, and it was lovely. It gave us a network of people who are so caring and lovely. And they mentioned through the Sunday school that they were going to visit an orphanage, because Hannah was in the Sunday school the following week. So I immediately felt a call to go. I was like, I have to go. I said to Eric, I'm going to go. And do you want to come? And he said, no, I wouldn't be able to go, because it was an orphanage or a home for abandoned and children with severe disabilities. So I thought, well, I'll be OK. I'll do it. But he said he couldn't handle it. So
like, it would have been just far too emotional.
I think so, yeah. And we just arrived, and we were 5 weeks there, and he was just trying to get his head straight to deal with the cultural change and then work. So for me, it was easier in a way, because I didn't have to deal with the whole work stress. Just Hannah in school and, you know, sitting by the pool the odd time. There was a hotel down the road with a pool. It wasn't all awful, Georgie.
So then you decided that this was something that you wanted to do when you were going to go. Did you go alone? You didn't go with...
So I was late. It was I was 20 minutes late because we were trying to find the place. So the group had gone ahead. So I just remember walking into the building and a girl about 16 years old, nearly the same height as me, ran towards me and jumped on me as if she wanted me to hold her. And she had urinated down her trousers, like the smell off her, God bless her. But she, you know, it was quite pungent. And I just remember that. That's something you'll always remember because it's all these senses. Mm-hmm. And they all came running over to take her off me. And I just remember going, no, it's OK, you know, because I was just in shock. And the room was full of children and adults with, a lot of disabilities and making noises. And it was strange and it was bizarre. It hit me. That's all I remember. And then I turned my eye to the right and there was this little girl sitting on a chair and she was clapping her hands to the songs. They were singing songs. And it was almost like there was a little light over her head and I couldn't take my eye off her. It was, I just kept looking over and she didn't look that disabled compared to a lot of the poor children that were there. And I remember thinking, why is she there? You know, she seems okay. And then I looked down and she was wearing little splints on her legs or something. And then I thought, okay, she must have a physical disability. So that was my first visual of Nisha at the orphanage in Candy.
And did you interact with her that day?
Yeah, so we were singing. They had the guitars out and there was other children. It was very distracting environment. So I just kind of let it be for a while. And then I decided I'd go find her because I didn't see her. So she was in another room. There was a main hall and then there was two wards off of the hall, or bedrooms, I guess you call them. So I went around to try and find her and she was sitting in a cot in the bedroom where the younger children were, and she reached her arms out for me to pick her up. Now, I'm sure she did that to many people, but, you know, for me at the time, it was like, she's doing it for me, you know. So again, I picked her up and she was wet. They didn't really have nappies. They just, yeah. So I couldn't believe the emotion I had. So when I had my own child, I didn't get that. I think I heard you speaking to some of the girls on the podcast that you've done about the feelings they had having their baby. Mm-hmm. You know, when you expect the fireworks, and some do and some don't. But I certainly didn't after Hannah. I was sick for a couple of years. I had postnatal. So I picked up Nisha and it was like a gift. It was like all the emotions that I didn't have initially with Hannah, which I do now, and our relationship's amazing. I got with her. A random meeting in an orphanage of a child that's not my own in the middle of a third world country, and I held her in my arms and it was literally like, she's my daughter. And I started crying and I couldn't stop for about an hour. I just held her and held her and held her. I went into the other bathroom area and I asked them to change her clothes. I said, please change, you know, because it was awful to feel her wet. As a mother, you want to just change them.
Yeah.
And I came back out and I held her again, but she clung on to me.
Right.
And it was just an hour. And I'll never forget it. I left the building going, I can never leave her behind.
Like, at that point, are you kind of panicking because you're trying to come to terms with what's happening?
Yeah, you're in a bit of a shock phase from what you've seen. Because, again, there was so many children there, Georgie, that were like, you know, severely disabled and dying. There was some dying. And so I was dealing with seeing that for the first time. So aside from the Nisha emotion, I was in shock at all these children there with burnt faces and crawling around the floors. There was adults who were defecating, and it was such a visual and a stir of emotions in me anyway. And then I was like, and there's a girl in there that's my daughter. It was like the most.
And how did you leave her? Like, how did you pull yourself away? Because you just had
I just had to put her down and I put her back in the cot and I left. And Eric was up in KFC on the main street with Hannah because they had a place. So I arrived up to Eric and Hannah and I was in tears. And Eric's like, you okay? You okay? And I said, oh, it was awful. But there was this child, and Eric lives in his own world anyway, but he was like, yeah, we're like, come on, Hannah. And I was like, no, you don't understand. There was this girl. And he didn't even hear me, I don't think. But we got home, and then in the evening I sat him down and I said, listen, I met this baby and she's had a profound effect on me. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, I feel like she's my daughter, like she's our daughter. And he said, we've only just arrived, Jenny. What? Like, of course he thought that, because he didn't see her. He didn't go in. There we are, 5 weeks into the trip. In the middle of Sri Lanka.
The last thing you ever expected to happen.
Exactly. We'd never discussed adoption in our lives. It wasn't, we thought one and I'm done. Like, that was me. I was like, I've one child. Yay. We can still have a nice life. Yay. You know, that's what I was thinking. And there I am.
So you did only plan to have one child?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I never went, oh, I can't, I'm going to have four kids, or no. So now I suffered after Hannah for a while. Mm. So that really cemented it. But I was happy. I had a little girl and I was like, life is great. And, you know, I know two only children and they're both amazing people. So that's a load of rubbish when people say, oh, you know, an only child, blah, blah. I'm sure it's challenging. But no, I know two only children and they're great, amazing people. So,
and do you remember going to bed that night, that first night that you'd met her?
Yeah. So I basically cried myself to sleep night after night because I looked out the window and there was beautiful scenery outside our window where we were staying. It was really kind of rural and there was stars and birds and you could hear all the animals and crickets and all the whole lot. And then I just start cry, like it was like a loss, because I remember thinking, what if Eric never wants to do this? Because, you know, it's such a big thing. It's the rest of your life and he has to be okay with it. And I thought, how can I just go home then? You know, I can't. So then I'd ring my friends at home and told them, and they were like, look, back off, you know, leave him alone. And, you know, you can't force this, Jenny. Like, this is huge. He needs to come to this. He needs to want this too for it to work.
And could you see a way of it happening? Like, you know, I would imagine adopting a child in a different country is very difficult.
Yeah.
But you could
didn't
see
even it. Go there, I'll be honest.
Okay.
It was almost like it was an emotion and I just was sort of going with that emotion. So, but it was like I left Hannah in the orphanage and walked out.
Oh my God, I can't imagine.
It's unexplainable how you can have that connection. And I always used to wonder with people who adopted children, what if you don't bond with them? Like, you know, what if you take the child home and you don't have that connection? Like, imagine. So that was always a word. Not that I thought about adoption much, but remember of seeing people. You know the way you go there in your head. You say, gosh, I wonder, imagine you.
How could it be the same, you know?
Yeah. But actually, if you do talk to people who've adopted children, they do have that connection 9 times out of 10. Even if the child is difficult, they do. So, you know, human nature is they take on that role as a parent and they love the child the same.
So did you take your friend's advice then and back off?
As best I could. I was laughing actually because I got a ring, you know, the old push present for having Hannah, and I plagued the man. And every time I come into the house, I'd do the whole like sad lip and he'd say, what's going on? Oh, the ring again. Is it the ring? And it took about a year. And I remember thinking, the ring was really hard.
Yes.
This is a whole different ball game. But anyway, I have the most incredible husband who is the biggest heart. And I know if any man was going to do this, it was going to be Eric Miller. So I prayed and prayed and prayed every night. And in December 2014, I woke up and there's a big net over the bed for the mosquitoes. And there was an iPad squashed against the net as I opened my eyes. And I was like, huh? So I said, what's that? And he said, read it. So I took it into the bed under the net. And it was a story about a Christian couple in America who adopted 9 children with special needs. 9. So he said to me, if they can do 9, we can do 1. And it was the best moment of my life.
And had he met her at this stage?
So the following week, I said, right, I'm going to go in again because maybe it was just hormonal. You know, maybe I just got very emotional and, you know, maybe I won't presume I won't love her anymore, but maybe I won't feel that intense connection again. I'll love all the children. So I asked the nuns, could I go in? I bought her a little teddy. I went into the bedroom again and she was on the ground this time and she can't walk, couldn't walk at the time. She's cerebral palsy. And she started crawling towards me going, ha, 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 at the top of her voice. And I then went, uh-oh, because I knew she felt the same way.
Oh my God.
Because I just stood there and she saw me and she'd only seen me one time. And she sees hundreds of volunteers going in and out of that place. And she had the same connection. And that's when I knew. I said, this is not imagination here. There's something happening between us.
Mm.
So Anyway, the following week, he came in.
Okay.
And I was waiting. I turned around. I was like, well, you know the way you... mm-hmm. It's not that he didn't say, wow, she's so gorgeous and beautiful and I love her. But he said, there's so many children in here. We need to love Jenny. And it was an amazing thing for him to say. But I was devastated. I was like, but not like her. You know, not like Nisha. But anyway, so then we go forward and then the iPad. Now, he went in with me and we'd start to work there.
Okay.
So we went.
And what was the people that ran the orphanage? Were they welcoming to you, or what do they think of your special bond with Nisha?
So they didn't like it. I got it reprimanded a couple of times. Now, I was subtle about it. And I did, you know, try not to go towards her. But of course, I wanted to hold her every time I saw her. But I was careful.
Why don't they like that?
Because it's not fair on the children.
Okay.
So thousands of volunteers come in and out of there every year, and if they targeted a particular child, the child will get attached and then the person leaves. So they have to feel all that abandonment all over again. So it's not fair. Mm-hmm. So they try and divide their love. And there's always the ones that get more attention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some just don't look as cute, you know, and they deserve just as much love. Nisha was particularly cute, so she got a lot of attention.
Okay.
So the nuns would shout at me sometimes, you know, you cannot just be with that one child. And I understood, but it was really hard.
And how were they treated, the children?
The nuns were amazing. They're Sisters of Charity, which is the Mother Teresa Foundation or Order, sorry. So they did their best. I mean, some of the carers were a bit gruff. You know, I saw a few, like, you know, spoons being hit over heads and things like that. But remember the pressure they were under. Like, there was 200 people there, adults and children. And some had very outrageous behaviours. A lot of them were abused. And, yeah, so they would throw food and they would hit. And so they defended themselves in the way they could, because some of them were big children. They weren't just little ones. So, but you know what? Compared to, I heard some of the government orphanages, they were given a lot of love. And Nisha was certainly loved, because now we have her. I know she was loved from the moment of conception. I feel she was loved because she has that spirit.
So did she, when did she get to the orphanage originally?
So apparently this is where the story starts to get. So it was, you know, God led, because she arrived in Colombo, from Colombo to Kandy, the exact time we arrived in Kandy. Yeah. So we found out, we went to the home that she originally was from to talk to the sisters and get some information about her. And when we started the adoption, and they said that she had been transferred in August 2014, which is when we arrived. So she was only there at the same time, which is amazing. So if she hadn't been transferred, the chance of me meeting her, I would not have gone to a home in Colombo.
Yeah.
I just went to a local one.
Mm-hmm.
Her story was that her mother was a young mum and couldn't take care of her, and she gave her to the nuns when she was 10 days old. I don't know if she knew that she had a disability at that point, because cerebral palsy doesn't show up for a while. But certainly, without judgment, and I often pray for the woman, because I saw a photo of her holding her and she's crying. So I don't think she ever wanted to leave her. And Georgie, the situation over there would be that the children, or the people, are suffering from severe poverty, and out of wedlock as well, having a child is just taboo. And also disabilities are extremely taboo, and they think they're cursed children. So there's many factors that we don't understand. So I don't like to say that she's abandoned, because I feel her mother loved her and loves her to this day. But I do think it's best to say that she was left with the sisters at 10 days. Yeah.
So she knew no different than the orphanage at that time. And
no.
Was she quite independent? Like, how old was she when you met her?
So she was two, but she was just becoming three. Just turning three, sorry, in October. So I met her in the end of September. But was she independent? Yes, they're extremely, if you think about it, for the first few years of their lives, the first few years of her life, she parented herself. So they take over the role of mother, father. So they protect themselves, they soothe themselves, you know, they don't get comforted. All those little things that we take for granted, when our baby cries, we run over, you know. I'm sure when your little baby cries, you go straight over to her and cuddle her, and they don't have that. When they're sick, they'd just be left in a bed and they'd have to comfort themselves. So they build up a kind of a strength within themselves. And I also think she kind of turned on the charm. So how she got love was charm. So okay. she would be the cute one. She became that role, and then people would pick her up, give her an extra biscuit or yogurt. I could see her in action. I used to watch her. So all the carers, they'd say, "Oh, she'd go," and she'd kiss them and hug them and love them, and then they give her another yogurt, you know? It was amazing. I was like, wow. And I truly believe, because one day in the car about a year ago, she said to me, "I was waiting for you." Right? And I was like, I was trying to not cry driving the car. I was like, "What?" "Yes, Mom, I was waiting for you." Now, what she probably meant was I was waiting for the first sucker to come in and look at them with the big brown eyes. But she had made a plan in herself, I believe, to get out of there. And she was getting out of there. And she was as charming as she could be to get out of there. I believe
it's just incredible.
Yeah.
So Eric showed you the iPad, and was that the moment that you felt like he was in?
100%. So we Skyped our family, which you do when you're pregnant and if you're away, to announce it. So we got them on the iPad, and we said, well, both sets of family separately. And we said, "Listen, we've some news." And they said, "What?" And we said, "We're extending our family." Now, they immediately thought I was pregnant, because I had no problem getting pregnant. I didn't think. I just didn't want, you know, I was happy with one. And they said, "What? You're pregnant?" And I said, no, we're considering trying to adopt a little girl we've met. And they were like, "What?" So then there was all that. But then we had to throw in, she's got cerebral palsy.
Mm.
So there was a bit of silence initially, but then the reactions were amazing. Yeah, they were crying and they were saying, "Are you sure you know what you're doing?" And we said, "Look, we love her and she's incredible and, you know, whatever. Like, we don't care. We know this is what we want to do and we can help her." And
You both worked in the orphanage at this point, and you were teaching in there.
My attempt to teach, there was like a little school they used to do and ring a bell and they'd all go over in the morning. Now, most of the class we had were so severely mentally disabled, they couldn't really do anything. We'd sit them in a little row and sing a song and try and get them to colour. But for Nisha and another couple of kids, they did get something out of it. So, but it was a way that we could go and see her every day as well.
And what was it like to leave her there every day?
Horrendous. Yeah. And it got worse. It got worse. And then when Eric really bonded with her, he was distraught because he didn't know how men, I think they can kind of hold off on emotion initially. But when they're full of emotion, like on a wedding day, they never think about their wedding day until they're actually at their wedding. And then they're in bits and you're grand because you go there. You think, "Oh, everyone I love is going to be in the room and the speeches and I'm going to be crying." And they don't go there. And then suddenly they get hit with all this emotion. So I think that's what happened to him. And it was very difficult to walk out of there every day. And then they started to say, as the adoption started to process, they would say "Amma" to me and "Tata," which is mom and dad. So they'd say to her, "This is Amma, this is Tata." So she'd start to call "Amma, Amma, Tata" to us. And then we taught her mom, dad. Mm. So in English then she'd say mom and dad. So near the end though, we had to be sure it was happening because it wasn't fair on her. So we didn't do that for a good while.
So did you not tell Hannah then for a while?
No, the first thing we did was ask Hannah.
Okay.
So before we Skyped our families, we called Hannah in and we said, "We want to talk to you and we're considering adopting this little girl. If it's not what you want, we're okay with that. You need to tell us. She'll be your sister. You should come home with us." And, you know, she was incredible. She said, "That's okay." Now, I don't know if she really understood, you know. But then we brought her in to meet Nisha and she started feeding her and was kind of loving on her. And
that must have been so incredibly special for you.
That was amazing. Because that was the fear of mine, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I adore and love Nisha. I adore and love Hannah. How's Hannah going to be? She's my firstborn. But when the little face came up and said, "That's okay. I'd like a sister," then we decided then, well, off we go. And we knew then we could try, at least try, because you never know until the last moment with adoption. It's always risky in that regard.
I can't imagine how scary that is, though, when your heart is set on a child, like it's your daughter.
Yeah.
To have to go through that agonizing legal stuff.
I think, to be honest, my faith is a huge part of this whole story. And I felt certainly God talking to me that day when I was holding her, saying, "This is your child. I want you to take guardianship of her. This is a job I have for you." So for me, every time I panicked going, "What if we don't get her?" What I thought, no, hang on. He wouldn't say that to me if it wasn't something that was going to end up coming good. You have your human emotions within that. But spiritually, I was like, I wouldn't have even felt that. I wouldn't have gone there. It's too huge. And the timing and the whole coincidence was too big. So that always gave me great hope. We had a great network of Christian friends over there who prayed all the time for Nisha. They came to the orphanage to visit her. They supported us. So we weren't alone over there. And that also made, they kept saying, no, God will, his promises will come. You'll get Nisha. It's going to happen. So that got me through the the human side, because you do fear. Of course you do. You'd never do it otherwise.
And was Nisha aware that this was happening and she was going to leave the orphanage one day?
No. So they did it very strategically. In fact, I think we were the first adoption in that orphanage ever, maybe in modern time anyway. We were also the first Irish couple to adopt a Sri Lankan child as residents in Sri Lanka ever. And we were also the first couple to adopt a child from Sri Lanka, international couple, in many years, because they shut the whole thing down. So there was a lot of firsts, which was not good because we were like, OK, you know, they had to be sure of us. And they put us through the ringer, which is the right thing to do. They home study reported us. We had to get police reports from every country we'd ever lived in. They interviewed us. There was so much bureaucracy. We couldn't do any bribery at all. There was, you know, that's something that's completely illegal. So Irish government would have shut it down. So we couldn't make it go quicker. We had to be patient. The lawyer overcharged us. So it was rife with things like that. But we had a lot of support. So we had a good lawyer and we were helped on that side of things. But yeah, there was days it was difficult. And near the end then, they started to prepare her. When they knew at the probation were pretty sure that it was happening and we had a court date, then they started to tell her, you know, you're going to be leaving with them. But of course, she was ready at that stage.
And her time in the orphanage, did they ever leave the building?
No,
like
no.
They never?
No, they were in a yard or a bed.
So
there was
no
toys,
like the outside world.
No, but one day myself and Eric arrived and we'd built up a very good relationship with the sisters. And also Hannah's school had done a fundraiser and we got them loads of equipment and they really respected us at that stage. So they said, Eric, Nisha needs to go to the hospital. Will you take her? Now, it was like winning the lottery. The two of us looked at each other because we did a little mini car thing. A Maruti car, it was funny. It was like a little tin can. But they said, will you bring her to the hospital? And we couldn't believe they were letting us remove her from the building and trusting us. Now, we had a chaperone come with us. But me and Eric, it was like the most exciting day of our lives. So on the way to the hospital, we said, let's pull in here and get an ice cream. Because she'd never had an ice cream, right? We have photos of this. I'm going to send you a photo.
Oh, God, I'm start crying.
So we pulled in and we brought her into the ice cream shop and we bought her an ice cream and we sat down. And it was absolutely the most, I've never felt so happy in my soul as that moment. And she was just licking away. She didn't know what to think of it initially. But then we photo of me holding her in the ice cream shop and we couldn't believe we had her out. It was the most, and she was sitting in the car. We're like, she's in the car. We took her to the hospital and they didn't have an appointment for her. We had to drive back. That was the most depressing drive because I wanted to just go then and fly.
Yeah.
And we had to put her back in.
A taste of life.
Yeah. And then we had to put her back in then. That was awful. And then she got really upset. So in hindsight, it probably wasn't a good idea.
And she just wanted to be
with
you guys.
They never let us do it again because she got really upset. But yeah, so that was an amazing moment in my life, actually. It's only now I'm talking to you, you forget all these things, you know, when you come home or it's good to reflect back, I think, sometimes and remember these incredible moments. And that was by far one of the highlights, I think.
Yes. So
sorry to upset you.
It's just because I think it's because Pia has just gotten to the stage where she loves ice cream.
Oh,
like she loves going for ice cream, you know, every child does.
I know, and it's such a normal thing.
Absolutely. Take it for granted, you know.
You do. Yeah.
And then tell me about the day then that you got her out.
Well, it was the December 2016 was really tough. His family came over and we were due to have her transfer. No, we were supposed to be putting the process of the courts together at that point, and they kept blocking. Papers weren't signed, and it was coming near Christmas, and I thought, I can't do Christmas without her, like, in there. It's going to be so hard. So we had friends there that we were working for another charity, which I'll come to at the end because it's something we're thinking of doing for the future. It's called Frids Row, and it's a fabulous children's home, which it's different. It, obviously, they're not all have severe disabilities, but they were. It's a Swedish organisation, and they really raise the children up to go into normal society. It's totally different to Diana Vassa, which is the home that she was in.
Okay.
We had friends there. So we rang them in bits. We said, listen, they're starting to tell us to not come in anymore because they were upsetting her too much. So they said, look, talk to the sisters. Let's see if we can get her transferred. We can transfer her over to the home here and you can move in with her and stay with her there. So we went in one day, and because, and you know what, sometimes in life you look back and think it was worth all those relationships. It was worth putting the time in. We spoke to the sisters and they never hesitated. They just signed the form. Because he said, if they don't sign it, Jenny, we can't do anything. And they said, no, give me the papers, Jenny. And they signed it. Wow. So we got the next day, they got a van and we arrived in to take her. And she was coming out with her little plastic bag, no shoes on. So happy. They had her all dolled up with the bracelets on and the talcum powder. I remember they used to put loads of talc all over with their dark skin and the big blobs of white talc. It was so funny. And the smell, I remember the talc. And we put her in the little van and she was just... That was the beautiful part of this adoption. And it's difficult to do an intercountry adoption in that regard, I feel, because you don't get to have that time with the child. But that's the way adoption's done. And it's successful. But we got to be with her. So when she walked out of the orphanage, well, not walked, but we held her, she knew she was coming home with us. And she was excited about that. She wasn't scared. So with the sad bits, there's the happy bits. Mm. So we took her to this other home and we lived with her there. With chaperones for 2 months, all of us in this one little room, Hannah and me on the floor, and she was in the bed with Eric. And
Eric was still coaching at this point, was he?
So Eric was the height of it. Yeah, he'd all his coaching going on, and Hannah was amazing. We used to have to wake her up at 5:30 because it was a good bit away from Candy, where the home was, and she had to go to school. School started at 7:15, so we'd have to wake her at like 5 a.m, and she never moaned. She got up. And off she went. I could never leave. I had to stay there. It was like being in prison. And I remember one time the bell went, you know, in an orphan, in a children's home, every lunchtime there's a bell. And I hopped into bed one night at 10 o'clock as the bell went. And I was like, oh, I was like, I'm becoming institutionalized.
And how did you get yourself through that time? Just because you knew this was all supposed to be
so
this way.
I was so excited to have her, Georgie. I was just bonding with her. And we'd go out on the little bike. We had our little routine. And she went to a little preschool on the campus thing. I just couldn't believe she was there. Just everything was a first, like drying her hair with a hairdryer. She was like, oh, yo, and she started jumping around with the heat. She never felt a hairdryer had it. Well, she obviously had the showers in the other place, but just those little small together moments as a family. There's a picture also on our, we did the fundraising a while ago now, but we had a page and she has doing her teeth the first night, her and Hannah, just the two of them doing their teeth. I was in their jammies. Like that was something I was craving. And then suddenly that was happening. So that got me through. And we knew we were getting closer to the court date. So we knew as soon as that was over and she was ours, then we could go out into the world with her or go, you know.
And did you want to go back to Ireland? Was there ever a part of you that thought you might stay there?
Yeah, oh, for sure. We wanted to stay for a while. But no school would take her. And her healthcare there wouldn't have been good at all. So that's when we started to make the move, which was a whole other chapter towards coming home, because we needed her to get an education and they're so marginalised over there. And I didn't want her to be stared at and people treat her differently. In Ireland, our attitude is so different. It's amazing.
So she couldn't walk by herself?
Yeah. So Nisha suffers from cerebral palsy. She's diaplegic, which means she's two clefts on both sides of her brain. They think that she had a stroke in the womb. So her language is fine and her upper body, but her lower body at that point wasn't functioning normally. She had a lot of spasticity in her muscles and she couldn't walk at all. But then we got her up onto a little frame. So she was able to get herself around by using her upper body strength, but her legs hardly worked at all at that point. So that would have been when we were over there. So she would have been very marginalised because of that. Because she never appeared to be normal because of equipment. You never see a child on the street over there in a wheelchair. You know, you just see the children that are begging with disabilities, but you don't see in mainstream schools or anything. It's just, it's taboo big time. So we had to make the decision. Okay. And then Eric lost his job as well, and just the whole thing just changed for us.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided, right, let's make a move and go home. Yeah.
And what was the day? What was it like when you were coming home that day?
We applied to come home, and then unfortunately the Irish government blocked us and wouldn't give her a visa because we did a domestic adoption in Sri Lanka. Not an intercountry adoption, which is the way it's done in Ireland to get the certificate. So that's when the real pain for me began, actually, because I was separated from Hannah. So it was Eric and Hannah came home in July 2016, and I was stuck out in Sri Lanka, and I had no idea when I was coming home with Nisha. So it was the most torturous time in my life, and I remember just saying to God, why is this happening to me? You know, I did what you said. I have Nisha now. We're going to love her for the rest of her life. But I miss my daughter. Like, I want to see Hannah. And I felt I'd sort of almost put Nisha before Hannah.
Mm.
And it hurt me so badly. And I miss them so much. It was very, I had to dig so deep over there, I tell you. And it was 100 days until I returned. And then on the other side of things, Eric was going through the mill over here. We had to hire barristers and lawyers. And we had to face, you know, panels, and he had to go in and, you know, and really speak the truth, which in fairness, it was the truth, and the truth will out. So in the end, they knew that we hadn't gone over to Sri Lanka to adopt a child. That's what we had to prove to them, because that's illegal.
Okay.
For good reason, but it was something that just happened in our family. We didn't plan anything. So anyway, in the end, we were sanctioned the visa, and I arrived into Dublin Airport, and I was so excited to hear Irish people. I was like, ah, I'm home. Got to the security and the immigration, and I handed the passport in with the visa, which took us so much pain to get. And the guy said, where's your letter from the adoption authority, your laminated letter or something? And I said, sorry, what? Now, I thought for a second, they're not going to let me in. But it was all legal. Anyway, it turned out that I think we hadn't sent it over to me or something. And he said, a lot of children have come in today. So it was obviously a day where children were coming home from adoptions. Anyway, I walked out of departures with Nisha, and it was amazing. My mom and dad were there, and his family, and my sisters, and my best friend arrived, and it was an amazing moment, and everyone was just hugging her, and yeah.
And what was Nisha like that day?
She was quiet. It was overwhelming, but she was amazing on the flight, because I hate flying, right? And we missed our flight then as well. The second part of our flight, nightmare. But we were on the plane, and it was turbulence, and I was panicking inside. And she goes, are you okay, Mom? I was like, what? You're on a like long haul flight leaving your country, and I'm in bits, and she's there. Are you okay? You okay, Mom?
She seems like such a caring little child. Like, yeah. It's like she was older than her years.
Yeah, she's been through so much in her little life. She's such an incredible human being. And anyone who meets her would agree she's a dynamic person. You know, it's not easy parenting her, I'll be honest. Like all our kids, it's hard. And there's days that I feel it's tiring, because she's so much energy and happy all the time. And I'm like, I'm having a bad day. And she just loves life. It's like she's won the lottery, and she's embracing every moment of her life.
And do you think that she obviously then remembers that time?
She does. We talk about it a bit, but we don't over talk about it. So okay. We still mention her little friend Delmony, who I'm so glad I knew Delmony, and she used to care for her, and they'd hop into each other's cots and stuff like that. So we can say, oh, you know, Delmony. And anytime we're throwing something out, she goes, no, Mom, we'll give it to Delmony. So she's aware of her past, but she doesn't dwell on her past.
Okay.
She loves Ireland. She loves her family and her extended family. She loves her life. She loves her school. So she just loves life. So she doesn't go back there often. But when I first got her home, I remember if I'd be like, you know, disciplining her like I would Hannah. We're big disciplinarians, me and Eric. We believe in the kids, you know, should be well behaved. She'd go in this starry look in her eye, like as if she was sort of going off somewhere in her thoughts. Maybe she was used to being over-disciplined in the orphanage in a bad way or something. I don't know. So I kind of thought, okay, I have to consider that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you need to discipline your kids. So it's to try and find that balance. But that was the only bit I remember. I'd lose her for a minute, and it was really sad. And I used to go, oh, but she's not doing that now. Okay. That was early days, but she's not doing that anymore.
And then you guys set up a GoFundMe page to raise money to bring Nisha to America to get.
Yeah.
It was a surgery, wasn't it?
Yeah. So when I first found out she had cerebral palsy in Sri Lanka, I Googled cerebral palsy treatment. And it said this guy, Dr. Park, came up, and it was actually an Irish kid that was on the video. So I thought, oh, well, I know that's out there. Now, I knew it would cost a fortune, the word America and medical treatment. You go, oh, my goodness. Mm. But we left it out there, and we were only home from an adoption. So, you know. So then we started to work with Enable Ireland. But I could just see that she just wasn't making the gains that I was hoping for. And I'm a trainer, and so is my husband. So we were like, this isn't adding up here. The spasticity is too strong. Even if we work with her, the next day it's back again. So we investigated, met some Irish families who'd gone to America, to Dr. Park in St. Louis, had great results. So we began fundraising in September 2016. 10 weeks later, we raised €100,000. It was an unbelievable experience. People were amazing.
What was that like? It isn't when people help you, it just means so much, doesn't it?
Yeah, I know you've obviously experienced that now with your illness, and how much if someone just sends you a text, gives you a hug, says the right word, it's everything. And funny, a lot of, I know the podcasts are about wellness, and I've been in this industry for a long time. But for me, the piece that's missing and that's important is actually community and helping other people. Mm-hmm. Like I'm sure that now that you can talk to somebody who's in treatment is the best feeling for you.
Yeah.
Not even the person that helped you, but that you're helping that person.
To pass it on.
Yeah, so I think social media is, it's all turning on itself now. And it's now becoming about us all loving one another. I know it sounds so cheesy, but I actually think this fake thing has just got a bit raw with people now. It's like, no, that's not what I want. That's not what I'm searching for. We all are looking for something. Mm. And if we can find it in each other and help one another, it's so idyllic, I know. But if you ask anyone, the giving is the bit that really makes you feel well in your soul, I think. So for me, in the industry of wellness, I was always going, yeah, I eat real well. I exercise. I meditate. But there's something missing inside me. But after doing what we did with Nisha, it filled me up. And I thought, okay, that's it. That's the other piece is sort of how can we mind each other? How can we love one another? And that's, to me, that's wellness.
Such a powerful message. I absolutely agree with everything you say. So you brought her to America, and tell us about the outcome of...
Yeah, so it was an amazing experience over there. The hospital was incredible. It was like Disneyland, you know, the big cuddly guys walking around and dogs. And it was just, it was bizarre, but it was amazing. But she did incredibly well, and actually the surgeons were fascinated with her level of pain, or with her level of tolerance of pain, and just how she coped with the operation compared to a lot of the other children. And we really feel it's because she's adopted and because of what her start in life. Mm. She's tougher. So it all just came good for her in the end, and she got out of bed after 3 days, and she was in the gym, and she never cried hardly. She was incredible. So now she is walking without any equipment. She's in a pair of splints. That's it. She's made massive strides. We're a year after the operation now. She's had her first sports day last week. I know.
Oh my God.
And she was in the egg and spoon. Now, Hannah said she was Paddy last in all the races, but she thought she was fantastic that she just got over the line. I won the gold, Mom. I was like, wow, you're incredible. So she just, even that, she doesn't go negative. But yeah, one of the physios who works with her said that he thinks by the time she goes to secondary school, you won't be able to tell she has cerebral palsy because she's doing so well.
And she just loves life.
Yeah, yeah. That's her essence, I think, is that she just is happy and she knows what she has now. You think children don't know? She knows because she was 4 when we adopted her. So she knows. That was then, this is now. And, you know, sometimes I think, I see her in church sometimes sitting with the group of African kids. She tends to radiate there. And I see her with them and I think that's her tribe. And it makes me go, it stings me a bit because I love her so much. But I think I've been given guardianship of her. I don't own her. Like Hannah, like all our kids, like Pia. You know, there's a connection, but they're their own human being. So same for Nisha. And I do believe that in the future she will go back. And I think she will probably settle there. But she'll have got such an opportunity because she will be walking and have an education. And of course, I hope she, you know, is still with us. That's my plan. But I have to let her fly as well. And that helps me with the moment that maybe as a teenager, she might say, you know, you're not my mom, or, you know, those moments.
Yeah.
But I'd be like, I've been given this beautiful job of raising her, me and Eric and Hannah. and our family. She's such a gift. And that's all they are. They're gifts and they have their own essence, I think, as well.
And will you bring her back there? Are you planning to go back?
So we're hoping in the future. Eric's now decided to go back to college to do physiotherapy. And we're hoping to set up a foundation over there and a project that we can help these kids and give them some kind of physiotherapy. So with Frids Road, there's a building there that's a hospital that used to be a hospital and it's now derelict. So we're hoping to reinvigorate there and open it as a sort of a physiotherapy clinic.
Will you fundraise for that?
Well, that's the plan. But for now, I want to get Hannah into secondary level and we have to consider her as well. So it's down the line. Eric's going to get qualified now as well, which is exciting. I'm so proud of him going back to college because it's not an easy thing. So, and I've had a load of people who said straight away they'd love to help. They'd love to come out and do maybe some volunteering. And it's such a beautiful place. It's in the forest and it's got like coconut trees and it's quite an idyllic location, this particular home. This is the one that took Nisha on as their guardian for us to adopt her. So, yeah, it's funny. You come home to Dublin and I love my country, of course, but there's a piece of me you'll never be the same. I'm sure you feel the same after your illness. It's like you're different. You've changed and you need to now live your life from this moment onwards.
Yeah,
it'll never go back to the way it was. And it's a really good thing. And you grieve your own life sometimes, but then you think, no, this is now my path and it's better and it's richer and it's got much more amazing people in your life too, I'm sure.
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of allowed me to be my true self. Like I had to dig deep so much during my cancer journey and really ask myself some tough questions. And I suppose it makes you think about how you want to spend your time and who you want
to
be with.
Who you want to spend your time with is a big one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Jenny, you are incredible. I feel so blessed that you came in to tell me that story today. Thank you so much. I just think you're so amazing. And it was just so lovely to hear the story from you because I've heard it through Becky, but you're incredible. And thank you so much for today.
But listen, keep doing what you're doing because I'm hooked now because I started listening to them. And then I was like, will you get off your phone? But I think we all need more of this. And also we need to get men talking too.
Yeah.
Because we're great and we keep going with the chats. But men need to come out now and start speaking too. And we've got a great opportunity now. And you guys have such a platform with all of this. And I think, as I said, wellness to me is well with your soul, not just well with your body. And with your soul as well, everything kicks off from there for sure.
Thank you so much.
Not at all.
Thanks for listening to the Good Glow podcast, made possible by Sally Hansen. To discover more, you can shop the products in Macaulay Health and Beauty Pharmacies and other stores across the country now. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please subscribe so you can be the first to hear about new ones. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review. To all my listeners in Ireland and those of you around the world, thank you for the amazing support and continued feedback. You can find out more about my story on thegoodglow.ie and follow me on Instagram at georgie.crawford.